Hey, leader, and welcome to episode number 307 of the L3 Leadership Podcast, where we are obsessed with helping you grow to your maximum potential and to maximize the impact of your leadership. My name is Doug Smith, and I am your host, and today's episode is brought to you by my friends at Baratung Advisors. If you're new to the podcast, welcome. I'm so glad that you're here, and I hope that you'll enjoy our content and become a subscriber. Know that you can also watch all of our episodes over on our YouTube channel as well, so subscribe there if you prefer YouTube. And if you've been listening to us for a while, thank you so much. Make sure that you're subscribed so you get all of the up-to-date content every single week. And if it's made an impact on your life, it would mean the world to me if you would leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or whatever app you listen to podcasts through. It really does help us to grow our audience and reach more leaders, which is our whole goal here at L3 Leadership. And in recent episodes, I've been highlighting some of the reviews that you've left. And today I want to highlight Bree Small's review. Bree said this. She said, "Leadership is hard. And this podcast is real, honest, and challenging. It's everything that a leader needs to hear." Thank you so much for that review, Bree. It fires me up. And thank you in advance for all of you who are going to go out and leave ratings and reviews. And again, that really does help us reach more leaders. So thank you in advance for that. Well, in today's episode of the podcast, you'll hear my conversation with Jessica Jackley. I've been wanting to interview Jessica for a long time, so it was an honor to finally be able to sit down and have a conversation with her. And for those who may not know Jessica, let me just tell you a little bit about her. She's an entrepreneur, investor, and speaker. Her work over the last decade is focused on financial inclusion, the sharing economy, and social justice. Currently, she's the founder of Altruists, offering at-home, kid-friendly volunteer projects for families, and a co-founder and general partner at Untapped Capital. You'll hear her share a little bit more about the story of Kiva and what she learned there, her thoughts on necessary endings, and what she's up to now, which is pretty awesome. So you're going to love this episode. But before we get into it, just a few announcements. This episode of the L3 Leadership Podcast is sponsored by Baratung Advisors. The financial advisors at Baratung Advisors help educate and empower clients to make informed financial decisions. You can find out how Baratung Advisors can help you develop a customized financial plan for your financial future by visiting their website at baratungadvisors.com. That's Beratung advisors.com. Securities and investment products and services offered through LPL Financial, member FINRA and SIPC, Baratung Advisors, LPL Financial, and L3 Leadership are separate entities. I also want to thank our sponsor, Henny Jewelers. They're a jeweler owned by my friend and mentor, John Henny. My wife, Laura, and I got our engagement and wedding rings at Henny Jewelers, and we just had a wonderful experience. And not only do they have great jewelry, but they also invest in people. In fact, for every couple that comes in engaged to their store, they give them a book to help them prepare for their marriage, and we just love that. So if you're in need of a good jeweler, check out hennyjewelers.com. And with all that being said, here's my conversation with Jessica Jackley. Enjoy. Well, hey, Jessica, thank you so much for being willing to do this interview. It was fun just catching up with you and realizing that,
yes,
you know my wife since she was probably 3 or 4, maybe even younger. So great connection there. We went to the same high school. And I'm really excited for this conversation. And, you know, you're most known for starting Kiva. And in your book, actually, Seth Godin wrote this about you. I thought it was an interesting place we could start. He said, Jessica Jackley didn't wait for permission to change the world. She just did it. It turns out you can, too. I love that description of you. Can you just say a little bit more about that and what that means to you?
Yes. I mean, it's funny. There are all these, I think, pretty cheesy kind of cliche sayings that you hear around Silicon Valley in particular, but in the startup world about like move fast, break stuff, you know, get out there and basically be bold. And it sounds at first blush, it sounds like sloppy, like just get in there, bull in a china shop, do your thing. And then like, suffer the consequence or deal with the consequences later. And I think there's certainly an attitude of like, you need to test and try and make something real, even in a small, scrappy, rough around the edges way, to really understand how the world will respond to it. And I love that piece of it. I love the spirit of it when it's that. What I don't love is obviously, I mean, nobody would say this, but like the connotation of being irresponsible about grabbing some resources, getting out there and testing, putting things out that are where you haven't done your homework. You know what I'm saying? So yeah, the permission piece in particular that Seth talks about, I love and is a big part of my story because I felt like I grew up in this beautiful, wonderful, supportive community and the rules really worked for me. Like getting permission and then maxing out whatever the boundaries were that existed, like doing something great within boundaries, doing something great after I had permission. That was the way I lived my life for a long time. I didn't feel like it held me back, but then as I got out into the real world and started my career, I realized there's really no one to give you permission to go build something and be an entrepreneur or live and work entrepreneurially. It's a lot about just deciding this is what's going to happen next. I'm going to go do it. And that's a beautiful sentiment. So I'm grateful for that quote. I love it. And it definitely resonates with a lot of pieces and a lot of steps that I've gotten to take.
Yeah. And I'm just curious about your upbringing. You know, I know your brother very well as well. And you two are incredible and doing incredible things. And so I'm just curious, you know, were you always wired the way you are, entrepreneurial, or was that something that was curated? You talked about, you know, you ultimately found out that no one has to give you permission, but did you feel freedom to go change the world by the way that you were raised by your parents or your grandparents? What did that look like?
Totally. I guess I would say this. I never would have used the word entrepreneurial. It was an unfamiliar and kind of weird word to me. I don't think I used it ever to describe myself until after Kiva had started and other people were talking about it as in a different way. And I realized, oh yeah, I guess we did become entrepreneurs through that. That's interesting. Social entrepreneurs. Cool. But it wasn't a word that I liked or resonated with me because I connected it with business. And I thought, I mean, I was wrong, you know, spoiler, the story changed and I realized I was incorrect. But in a pretty black and white way, I thought about businesses, bad businesses, about taking and tricking people to give you their money and getting them to buy something they didn't need in the first place. I just wasn't into it. And a lot of the businesses were building or making things like that that didn't matter, that nobody needed more of. And so I skipped over like wanting to learn anything about that. I never took a business course, nothing. And instead, you know, I studied philosophy and poetry and political science, things like that in college. And I wanted to ask and answer big questions. And I thought if truth lives everywhere, if I can get at it, if I can figure out what's true and real and how, you know, I just so believed that, and I do believe that when you are correct and true and authentic in terms of understanding what you believe, holding on to those, even just a handful I keep using the word truths. I'm trying to think of another one, but like those values that you hold, the way the frameworks can guide you to be really effective in the world. If you get those basic building blocks of how you see other people, how you see the world, what you know matters in the world. I think that everything stems from that. And to me, businesses, again, broad brushstrokes, I'm summarizing like decades of my life. Businesses were making stuff that didn't matter to me. And I saw a lot of nonprofits doing the good stuff, like actually being helpers and contributors and givers. And in so many ways, being the opposite of big, bad, evil business, the way I inaccurately categorized it. It's a long answer, but I thought entrepreneurs, oh my gosh, they're like the gang leaders. They're starting new businesses. Like, no, thank you. No. But what I did know is that I wanted to go make things happen in the world. I wanted to move around resources and people to like fix and heal and set things right and kind of nudge systems towards being more just. I had a lot of aspirations to do that. I honestly didn't necessarily think it would mean starting something from scratch, not just once, but now looking back over the last 20 years, many times. I was ready to jump into a great organization and like do my best and follow the rules. And like, I don't even know what I was thinking exactly because it's not a clear path, but work my way up or something to like run an amazing nonprofit. And I know this is a long answer, but I have to tell you, I had this vivid memory and I talked about it earlier this week in a different podcast recording. And so it's fresh, but I remember, so I was an intern for World Vision one summer. And one of the things that I did was manage the child sponsorship program at the time, or parts of it, not manage the whole darn thing, but I was like trying to push that program forward and get the word out about it. So tiny role, but that was the area that I got to dabble in. And I remember I had like this file drawer down to the, anyone that's seeing this video and like looking to the bottom right, because I would open the drawer and they would be there, like photographs of kids on paper, super old school, not digitized, nothing like that. And I remember having this great summer, learning so much, doing what I could do to like help the kids in the drawer. And then I remember near the end of the summer, World Vision got a new leader and it was Rich Stearns. Okay. Now I don't know offhand, I should just look this up. I should have after I said it a few days ago. I don't know if he's still there today. I think he probably is, but I remember thinking, wait, what? Who's this business guy? He worked at like Lennox or something. It felt to me like super unrelated. Like this business doing something that was not about relief and development. And I was like, who's this business guy coming in to run things? I don't get it. Like, why wouldn't someone in the organization, again, like work their way up to become the next leader? And that's not what happened. And that was one of the very first moments for me where I was like, huh, maybe business skills, entrepreneurial thinking, like maybe there's something there. Maybe it could be used for good. Because clearly this guy's background, somebody out there thinks is going to be useful. Of course, he's an incredible leader. Long answer, not short answer. Nope, I didn't think of myself as an entrepreneur, but I did want to go do stuff. And I would kind of do, was sort of agnostic as to like how and where and what that would look like, what my title would be. But I knew I wanted to get into the mix and make changes that could help people. For anyone listening or watching that doesn't know what Kiva is, so way back in the spring of 2004, my goodness, I was doing an internship, me and my internships in East Africa. And I was with a nonprofit that gave $100 grants to farmers and goat herders and small kiosk owners. Maybe, you know, they'd sell onions and tomatoes and that was it during the day. Maybe it was somebody raising chickens. Maybe it was a tailor or seamstress that just made clothing by hand. And that was what they did to create a livelihood for themselves. So I was there seeing what $100 could do in the life of somebody doing a micro enterprise. And it was just sort of a magical experience for me where I got to see again and again how that tiny amount of money with some business training, one of the other places I saw, oh, business can be helpful, or business thinking, right? I saw how much difference it made in those people's lives. I saw how becoming entrepreneurial in their thinking and kind of owning their own path, deciding to kind of bootstrap and lift themselves out of poverty by not just doing their day-to-day business activities, but building these micro enterprises that become little machines for the sustainable livelihood to flow and flow into their families. I was blown away by a few things there. One, like these stories that I was hearing direct from people in Kenya and Uganda and Tanzania, living in very rural, very socioeconomically disadvantaged environments. I heard stories of hope and yeah, there were challenges too, but like it wasn't just a carefully crafted marketing story that I heard from many well-intentioned nonprofits that would only talk about the sadness and suffering and desperation and, hey, please swoop in and help. I was talking to equals, obviously. I was talking to people who were doing unbelievable things day to day, more than I could have done with the little bit they had. And what they needed was access to fair capital. And it was such a different, not just a shift in my mindset, but in my heart. My heart had opened up in a way that it hadn't before, because truthfully, I didn't see a possibility for my role to be much more than a donor that felt really bad every time I heard the sad story. And then I'd go on with my day. But when I was there meeting entrepreneurs, understanding the good, bad, and challenging parts of their lives, like I saw that there was an opportunity to provide not just grants, which are great and actually super helpful for people at that stage to like get onto the first rung of the economic ladder. But after that, loans made a lot of sense for so many of them. Naively, I didn't know about a lot of the lending organizations that existed in Kenya and Uganda and Tanzania at the time. And I thought, especially in these rural areas where nobody seemed to be reaching with a loan product, I thought, well, what if my friends and family would gather together a little bit of money and loaned to my new friends in Uganda? And that was the beginning of Kiva. And people loaned their money, you know, $25, $50 at a time, 0% interest to lenders. And then over the first few months, again, it was like early 04, it was 04 and 05, people were paid. The first seven entrepreneurs that we loaned, I don't know, $3,000-ish to in $300 and $500 loan amounts was repaid. And my co-founder, Matt, and I basically said, I think this is a thing. Let's do another round and another and another. And over time, Kiva's totally grown. So today and from day one, it's been a platform where anybody with a PayPal account or a credit card can go lend 25, 50 or whatever you want to loan to amazing entrepreneurs that need access to fair capital. And over time you get repaid and you get to hear and kind of follow the story of their business successes over the course of the loan. And 90, gosh, I don't even know exactly the numbers. The website is always smarter than I am on this, so we can double check my stats. But it's like it's always hovered around like 98, 99% repayment rates, which is amazing, right? I mean, wow. It's incredible. And it's because the individuals that are supported on the platform do not have a lot to their names. But this is their chance to change their lives, and they take it, and they're incredible. So yeah, just to give you like a feel for how the years unfolded. So beta round, like little pilot round of loans was $3,000. We actually took the word beta off of the site and said, no, we've launched for real, like nothing professional official happened. We weren't even like a registered 501c3 at that point, I think. And then we spammed more friends and family and said, here's another dozen entrepreneurs that need a loan. We think it's legal. Let's do it. That first year, we like scrambled and had more rounds and more rounds and more rounds of loans. And that first year, it was 500,000 in loans. The next year, it was 15 million. The next 40, the next 100. He was closing in on like 1.7, if it's not crossed already, but 1.7-ish billion in loans, $25 at a time from everyday people all around the planet who say, yeah, I think this other person who today has a need that needs to be filled, I think they deserve a chance. And I'm going to lend to them and I will take on default risk and currency exchange risk. And I will take the risk. It's probably going to work out. And a lot of people have been given those opportunities that they wouldn't have otherwise had. So it's been a magical, beautiful thing to get to be a part of. Long answers today, but you can edit and cut me however you need.
I love long answers. Do you have a favorite story maybe of an entrepreneur who got invested in and built a business that was incredible?
I mean, it's like asking, do I have a favorite kid? I can't say yes. I will say that one of the go-tos for me is the story of the person after whom I named my book, Clay Water Brick. So, you know, one of the earliest people that I met, a guy I'll call Patrick, he basically talked about like fleeing the northern area of Uganda when a rebel group attacked his village. He lost everything, but he and his brother got away. And they kind of landed on a border town, Tororo, border of Kenya and Uganda, with some cousins. But they had to survive. They were welcome to sort of crash with the family, but they needed to figure out how to have a livelihood and contribute. So basically, I'm summarizing quite a number of months and years unfolding in Patrick's life. But basically, one day, he starts to dig into the earth and learns that there are clay deposits right in the sort of front yard area in the land of his cousins where he's staying. And if he mixes the clay with water, it can form bricks. And so he does this again and again and again and again, day after day. And it gets better and better to the point where he can sell the bricks for like fractions of a penny each. So he does that again, day after day after day. Is able to eventually buy like a small wooden brick mold. Instantly his production goes up. He can do more and higher quality stuff. He does that day after day. Then he can buy a shovel, then he can buy a trowel, and he can buy some more tools. And when I met him, he was a few years into his business. He had several employees. He had built a handful of different houses around the community out of these beautiful bricks. And, you know, there's so many other pieces, like details to the story that are so fun. Like at one point he was like, huh, I can dry my bricks in the sun, but I know that they're stronger if I can bake them in a kiln. Let me figure out how to do that. So he learned from a guy in a nearby village and comes back and learns how to build this self-contained kiln and fire in the belly of it. And make bricks itself or even more, and just continually makes these improvements to his venture that led him to be a leader in his community and provide a livelihood, not just for himself and his family, but for others too. So things like that. I mean, imagine hearing hundreds, literally hundreds of those stories over the years. I mean, probably thousands in terms of through Kiva's platform, but it's very, very hard to hone in on any one that's more special than the other. They're all kind of the point, right? Of, one of the many points, I guess, of Kiva, like every story deserves to be told. Every story is unique and worth hearing, you know?
Yeah. And thank you so much for initially seeing a need and doing something about it. I guess I would be curious, what career advice do you have for people? You know, you talked about you were willing to just go work at an organization and make a difference and be happy with that. But then you saw a need and thought, hey, there may be something here. I think there's a lot of leaders listening to this who may feel similar. Hey, I could work the job I'm in and continue to grow and develop and be happy. But I also occasionally see needs that I feel like I'm supposed to do something about, or I have a dream. What would you tell them?
I don't think making an organization up from scratch is necessarily better or more effective to get the job done. I want to be really like careful about that. I think, you know, I certainly have lived in places, Silicon Valley, Los Angeles is quite entrepreneurial in its own awesome way. Everyone's sort of an S-corp doing 20 things and has like a portfolio of work, and it's really fun. But I think entrepreneurship can be over-glorified as this like spectacular higher path. And it's one, you can work entrepreneurially within a bigger organization. You can jump in to a new organization that's, you know, only a year old and has a handful of people, and like, there's so many ways and places to contribute. I think the way that I like to think about it is when you have a new idea and it's disruptive in some way. Like it threatens the status quo. It questions the way things have been done for a long time. Know that there might be pushback that's not always totally rational or data based from people in existing institutions who might have already invested a lot of time and energy and heart into doing things one way. So if you have a new way, you got to get into the psychology of it, but it's very threatening, right? To somebody who's like logged 20 years doing it the way it's always been done. So for, since we've gone into the Kiva example so deeply, you know, a lot of people in the nonprofit sector, we took it to organizations. We're like, this sounds fun, right? Do you guys want to do it? Can we do it for you? We don't even need to get paid. But what do you think? And they were like, no, too risky. It's weird. I don't get it. It's not a tax deductible donation. Nobody's going to want to do it. And then investor types, like VCs, et cetera, were like, I don't understand. Why aren't you trying to make, if these are actually going to be successful, like why wouldn't there be even a tiny amount of interest? The market, air quotes for those who can't see me, the market will want that. There are a number of other pushbacks too. But basically, if you have an idea, think carefully and try to unpack not just why people might push back. Like I'd say, do it where you are, do it with whatever resources you have around you and try to get it done in the most like efficient way, right? If it requires building something new or requires experimenting off to the side, that's cool. That's totally fine. Not better or worse. But if you can do it where you are, there's a lot of, there's a lot more like safety, so to speak, or resilience to do it within an organization. And a lot of nonprofits, by the way, I don't know how many of your listeners work in actual nonprofits or churches, but like those are the places I think where a lot of innovation, a lot more innovation can happen than does already. That's a whole other thread, but, let me step back and you asked me for career advice. If somebody wants to go do something bigger or beyond what's in front of them day to day in the job that they're currently in, I guess my very specific advice would be do a pilot, right? Do a project with a start and a finish, something discrete. Name your assumptions, test those assumptions, see what proves out to be true, see what you needed to tweak that wasn't quite what you expected it would be, and then go from there. So like Kiva, it was a start and a finish. It was one round of loans, seven people. We learned X, Y, and Z. We did a second round and we like adjusted and iterated, right? And then did another one and another one and another one. That's a lot less pressure. And it's like in and of itself, you'll get something good done probably versus the pressure of, I need to have the next decade planned. I need to have this grand like business plan with every scenario thought out and long-term sort of forecasts. Well, I mean, that's fun. If you like, I like to geek out on that stuff. But like, you can also say, I want to try this specific thing with this specific group of people over the next 3 months or the next 6 months and do like a rapid prototype, get something out there, get feedback, and then keep building on what's working. So that's my best advice, like project level, time bound, limited set of assumptions and set of, you know, goals, and then learn as much as you can and then see where things are. And you might find you want to change a lot. You might find you want to stop. Wasn't what you thought it would be. You might find you've cracked into something really big and then you can build more rounds, you know?
There's so much I want to go into based on several things you said. I did want to ask one question though. Going back to, you talked about just, you know, most organizations just market the need of people of, hey, this person's in dire need. And if you don't, you know, support, what have you learned? You started Kiva basically because you care for people and specifically the poor. And you opened your TED talk with a scripture of Jesus' heart for the poor. And I'm just curious, you know, over your journey, what have you learned about serving the poor and what the Bible calls the least of these in your career?
I think what people often forget, all of us often forget, is that we all have the same needs. We all need the basics, food, water, shelter. We all need the same things as human beings, right? What's crazy to me and amazing is that in my life, most of the needs are met every day, like clockwork, easily. Not that I don't do my best and work hard and try to, you know, earn a living and contribute. Not, of course, those things are true, but in general, the number of days of my life where I have truly been hungry, the number of days in my life where I couldn't access clean water or I didn't have enough clothes on my back to be warm and cozy or that I slept in a, you know, anywhere other than a really comfortable bed, right? Like I have what I, my needs are met. It's not that they don't exist. And I think one of the gifts of getting to work all around the world with people who live in very different ways is it helps me understand just in a universal, at this broad level, like what does it mean to be a human being on this planet? And what incredible gifts, like layers upon layers of gifts and love and generosity has enabled my life. It really fuels me. Again, it's so selfish. Like it really fuels me with gratitude. And I use that to do my best at giving back, because what else could I possibly do? I mean, it's like, it's abundance. It's abundance upon abundance. I have everything, everything. And a lot of us have everything. A lot of people listening have everything, everything they need. And so to really be in touch with that, gosh, it's like a joy activation tool for sure. But also it makes you realize like I'm hesitant with my words because I don't want to say how easy it is to help, but truthfully, you know, there's so much we could do every day. When I talk to people, I'll be really direct with you. When I talk to people who are like, gosh, I don't know, you know, which organizations are worth giving to or where do I begin? I get it. And I also think, oh my God, begin anywhere. Freaking like the whole world is broken and needs help. Yes. Just do anything. It'll be good. Like get started and then you'll learn and you'll figure it out. But, you know, it's funny too, because I haven't talked about my book that much in years. And here we are talking about it twice in a sitting, at least. The tagline of it, it's Claywater Brick. And then, learning from entrepreneurs who do the most with the least, basically, I think I misquoted my own book, but whatever. It's the idea is again and again and again, the magic that I got to glimpse again, like just being on the sidelines and cheering on entrepreneurs in very different circumstances than you or I have ever probably really existed for any length of time. To see what people do with so little is so empowering. So empowering. There's always a way through. There's always a way to take a next step. There's easy ways and hard ways, but there are ways, you know, and that's very life-giving to me.
Yeah. I'm curious as far as that as well, what role has your faith played in the work that you do, in the work that you started?
You know, I'm grateful that from a young age, I have exercised the faith muscle, like the part of my heart and my soul and my brain that believes in things that are unseen, that believes in things in the future that will unfold, that believes in the value of planting a seed and not necessarily being able to justify it with metrics about what happened the next day or the next week, like to think about long-term, to think about legacy, to think about just the arc of one's lifetime, right? Like, and how you want to show up, what you want to contribute. I know I'm speaking in very, very broad terms, but as I, you know, this is a huge subject for me because I grew up super connected, believing so deeply that I was connected to something bigger than me. And I think that was one of the healthiest and best pieces of my life. It's not just utilitarian either, obviously, right? It's not like, look how effective it is in getting things done to pray every day. But truthfully, I felt mostly, usually pretty centered, pretty clear on what I thought and believed. And then as life comes at you fast, it's easier to make decisions quickly when you already know what you believe about something. You've already sort of positioned yourself to screen for, I don't know, I don't want to say good choices and bad choices, but I'm thinking about like language that I use with my own children. And you didn't ask this, but so as anyone who would Google me for 2 seconds might see very quickly, I am pretty vocal and celebratory perhaps about being in an interfaith marriage. I'm married to a very loud Muslim and a scholar of religions who's just not really in any single box. He's obsessed. I mean, he's quite obsessed with Jesus. We pray together daily. I believe are connected to the same God, but we have very different faith journeys and different stories and rituals and metaphors and, you know, cultural stuff associated with each of our paths that in my experience, I'm just one person, but in my experience, it's been very enriching because at the end of the day, I know that I'm the boss of my connection with God. I'm the boss of my spiritual journey. I love having community and support and a partner that absolutely not just kind of cheers it on, but enriches that and provides all these different beautiful facets that I don't think I would have ever seen before when we have conversations about God and the nature of God and what that means in our lives. So I think it's like wonderful. And as I talk to my kids, the thing that we center on, it's funny, you mentioned a TED talk. I did a TEDx talk, a Stanford TEDx talk with him also in the last few years on doing interfaith family. And one of the ways that we think about it is we are unified in certain pieces that bring us depth and cohesiveness and like rally our family around a center, you know, and there are these practices and ways of like tools, really. I mean, this is how we pray, boys, like, and now my daughter too, but this is how we pray. This is how we worship. This is how we do community. And we regularly go in non-pandemic times. It's been tricky, but we regularly go to All Saints in Pasadena, this beautiful, really, I think, like radical, beautiful, diverse church community where we feel ridiculously accepted. I mean, Reza gives sermons there sometimes. anyway, so that's our depth. That's our core. But we also do, we really make an effort to teach our kids about world religions, all different kinds, because it's to us a way of understanding, again, like understanding what it means to be human on the planet, understanding other cultures and being literate in the world so that you can get other people's perspectives and have respect and a little bit of a depth of understanding about what they see, the words they might use, the frameworks and references that are important to them. So you can actually connect with others without feeling, fear or confusion or a lot of the things that can block us from just deeply diving into knowing another human being without agenda, you know?
So good. Thank you so much for sharing that unique perspective. I love that. I want to go back to your journey. So Kiva wasn't the end of your journey professionally. You went on to start a company called ProFounder, I believe is the way to say it. And so,
yeah, you got it.
And in listening to you, it sounds like the assumption was, hey, Kiva blew up and was a huge success. And so almost kind of like the Midas touch, anything I touch will be able to do the same thing. And that was not the experience, is my understanding of ProFounder. Can you talk about that? And, you know, Henry Cloud wrote a book called Necessary Endings that I think is really, really fascinating. And I would just love to hear you talk about, you know, that part of your journey and maybe even just the subject of necessary endings, if that strikes a chord with you.
Yeah, that's beautiful. It's a lovely question. And I don't think I've ever been asked it quite that way. So I love it. ProFounder was an attempt pre-Jobs Act, pre-crowdfunding laws that exist today. And I don't want to get into the legal ridiculousness of it, but basically today, thanks to Title IV of the Jobs Act, which, if I may say so, we helped draft that language. It was very exciting. But today, you can raise up to $1 million from as many people as you want. You can do it on equity. You can kind of do a giant crowdfunding raise. Giant $1 million, but still, it's pretty big. And that's a thing you can do today. But before, it wasn't clear how to do that legally. And so ProFounder was an attempt to sort of allow Small Business America and early stage startups that may not have been as high growth or not have had an obvious liquidity event in the future to raise capital from friends, family, and people that they knew. And usually, almost always, people did this structured around revenue share versus actual equity or ownership in the company. It was tricky. It was a correct idea, to be honest with you. Like, that was the right thing to do. It was really early. It was really early. And as soon as the Jobs Act started to become a thing, a few years into ProFounder's existence, we realized, what we've solved for is existing law, existing restrictions. When this thing passes, it'll open up all sorts of new possibilities. What do we do in the meantime? Because there's like the day that Obama signs it into law, which we like got to go see in the Rose Garden. It was so fun. And then you wait for a while for the SEC to make laws around it, make rules around those laws and like really make it super specific. And long story short, we decided we weren't going to wait it out. We weren't going to really start from scratch and pivot around these future kind of still cloudy, laws, or not laws, rules. So we decided to wind down the company. I was also notably quite pregnant with twins, and we kept the company going with my first two kiddos. We kept the company going until the twins, I want to say, were 3 or 4 months. But it was clear that it was like not the right time to push forward with the thing that we had built, and it still felt too uncertain and really like not a good thing to take a bunch of investor money and build something that we hoped would get it right in the future, because it was just going to be a bit of a waiting game before we could really utilize what the law made possible. So all that said, we wound down a company that it was very different than Kiva. And at the moment when we had offers for funding to do this pivot and build something we hoped would work, it was professionally, I had all the justification that I thought, I had a lot of justification for saying this isn't the right time. There's too much risk, too many unknowns. It's not the right moment to do this. Let's wait and see. But personally, I knew I was brand new at being a mom, brand new at parenting. And I knew that if I looked back on my life and I had not shown up for my kids in the way that I, no judgment to anyone, any work style, any balance, but for me, I wanted to be there with my two brand new babies in a way that I felt like I couldn't promise to investors I would throw myself into the business like I had before. And it just didn't feel right to keep going. And so I felt really good. Like it was a very healthy, good, eyes wide open sort of choice. But yeah, it certainly wasn't a Kiva level success. And then since then, I don't know if I'm fast forwarding too much, but then over the last 10 years, I mentioned my twins are now 10. I've done a number of different things. And a lot of my work has been really designed around being able to parent and show up for my family in this like non-negotiable way. And so I work weird hours. I do weird combinations of like projects. I have a lot. I talked about the LA sort of portfolio approach to work. Until the last year and a half or two, that's been what I've done more often than not. Doing consulting projects, building a small consulting firm for a few years. I wrote a book. I teach at USC on and off over the last decade, a course called Entrepreneurial Solutions to the Global Goals. I've done a lot of different things. I actually worked at a neobank for a while. So I actually did have a full-time like adulting it job for the first time ever at 40 or 41 at a company that I didn't make up in my own head. So that was interesting. But over the last 2 years, the two pieces that I'm doing now that again, I crank out what I need to during day regular work hours, like usually around 9 to 3. And then I get up at 5:30 most days and I get in some time then. I take a handful of nights a week and work after the kids go to bed. And I don't feel like it's, I wouldn't call myself at all like a workaholic. I'm so grateful for the flexibility to both be present from like 3 to 7 and in the mornings on weekdays with my family. And I kind of can't imagine doing it any other way. So you asked me way back about ProFounder and what that was about and the necessary ending there. And I feel proud of it. I feel proud of what we did. I talked before too about testing assumptions. We had some assumptions. We tested those out. We learned a ton. Our investors with us learned. And then when it was time to say, okay, this is how the world has changed, and here's what we believe is the next right step, it feels more like a rational, non like egocentric sort of move versus a failure. There's a lot of testosterone-y sort of like, go, 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 keep moving, building at all costs in sort of the old school, traditional, Silicon Valley mindset. Again, it's not fair. It's not correct. It's not what actual Silicon Valley is to me, but there's a vibe there. There are communities that think that way. And we definitely had people that I think would have preferred that we keep going and would have thought that we should have kept going at all costs. But I wasn't of that mindset. And I'm really glad that we stepped back, reassessed, and decided to wind it down when we did.
Yeah. Jessica, I'm curious, I think the work that you did created a platform for you more than, at least my sense is, more than you seeking out a platform. That doesn't seem like that's you. We live in a world where everyone wants a platform. Everything that you're talking about that you get to do, we live in a culture where everyone wants to do that. Everyone wants to write a book. They'd love to lecture at a university. You've gotten to connect with some of the most high profile entrepreneurs in the country or in the world for that matter. I'm just curious, what have you learned about having a platform? Is everything it's cracked up to be? Do you enjoy it? Do you hate it? Talk to leaders today that are striving to have what you have.
I probably should. Like if I gave myself career advice 10 years ago, today, I probably should work on that, like work on the platform and make a more of an effort to grow it or to utilize it. It doesn't feel that way to me. It's felt like these very, it's felt very organic, like relationships. I know that I see it. I have had incredible opportunities. Kiva has busted doors open for me. And then I went back and got my MBA at Stanford. That blew open doors for me. There, again and again, I've had these advantages and I am grateful for them. In terms of platform, I've never had goals around that. I've never had, I need to get to X number of followers or something. And I probably don't take advantage of it as much as I should. But I think I have a bit of a, wherever this comes from in my psychology, like I have a fear of, I want to do the thing itself. You know what I mean? Like I got away with, and that's what it feels like to me. I was so freaking lucky to get to do lectures for a decade and have that be the majority of my income. What? Like that's to me. So it's so fun, but I didn't make a big attempt to build it into a brand or to utilize, like to build out the platform where I just sort of did the jobs in front of me. And I don't know, maybe there's something to that. Maybe not. Maybe it's a total lost set of opportunities, but my goal is to do the thing itself, to build successful little machines for good in the world. And there's a lot of noise out there. I don't want to add to the noise. I want to say things that I need to say and that matter, but I'm not looking to crank out content for the sake of cranking out content. I'm not looking to tweet 8 times a day so that I have some sort of, I don't know. It's just not my thing. So probably an unsophisticated, disappointing answer, but that's how I think about it. I mean, I will say this one little other piece. I do look back at my career thus far and it feels weirdly natural, but I feel comfortable and sort of uber connected in the world in a way that whether it's true or not, I mean, I don't, who knows everybody, nobody knows everybody, but I feel like I know such a wonderful community of people that I can reach out to almost anybody. Again, like this includes cold calls and stuff, which I'm doing lately for my new business. but I don't know where that came from and I don't know how much of it is actually true or not, but I feel really comfortable. Like we are all connected. There's a way to find the person that you need and that you want to get insight from or wisdom from or partner with. There's always a way to do that and to find your way. It's just a matter of asking and maybe you have to make 4 asks in a row down the line, but you can find the people that you need, you know?
Yeah. In the few minutes that we have left, anything else you want to talk to leaders about today? Maybe your new venture or anything else you'd leave us with?
Yeah, I want to talk about my new venture. Okay. So I have a fund, which is amazing. It's called Untapped Capital. We invest in seed, pre-seed stage entrepreneurs who we believe we can like catalyze their growth, whether that's adding to their network or giving them guidance on getting more tech enabled or whatever else it is. But it's often a matter of, in the spirit of the topic we just covered, of connecting them with the people and then the resources that they need to get to the next level. So that's great. And I love it. I also, the majority of my work days and my waking hours is spent on altruists. So 2 L's, altruists.com. Altruists is, we're an organization that makes volunteer projects in a box and we do them. We make projects that are kid friendly, kid centered. So you can do them with your family at any time, anywhere, sort of from the comfort of your living room. So again, anyone who's not watching, you're missing stuff, but this one, so in December, so we tackle a big issue every month. And for example, in December, we worked with Charity Water. This is the box for the Charity Water experience. And the box is so cool. It always becomes something. This is like a little model of a water table and then the pump and the well that wow. comes from it. But basically every box has learning materials, an actual volunteer project, like an impact project. Oftentimes you make or personalize or contribute to something and then send it off in the world. But many times you also just do something to do better at home, right? So we've had boxes where to fight homelessness and support people who are unhoused and soon to be housed. Actually, we work with an amazing nonprofit called New Story, and kids make keychains that are mailed to Mexico so that our partner organization can hand them out to families about to move into the brand new homes that they built for them. Again, first key on the keychain that our kids have made. And then we did one on saving the pollinators. So you make a little bee hotel out of the box. There's one on clean water, of course. There's one on food insecurity. Kids color in a reusable grocery bag. I have that here actually in my messy office, but they color in a reusable grocery bag and send it to our partners in Nashville, the store. It's a beautiful nonprofit that's a food pantry styled as a grocery store that was launched by Brad Paisley and Kimberly Williams Paisley. They're awesome. And we're so proud to be associated with them. And there's other boxes on, you know, energy poverty and solar lights. There's boxes, there's one shipping in a few days on shelter pets. It's very sweet and light and friendly. Like, kids make dog toys and cat toys for animals in animal shelters. There's one coming up on helping migratory birds. We're so psyched. It's with International Bird Rescue, and kids basically like, what's the word? I don't have a verb for this, or like an adjective, like not bird proof, but they put window clings on windows where birds could smash into them, and they make a little bird feeder and make little binoculars to be bird watchers. It's super sweet. Anyway, altruists, the like actual experiences, you get to do something good with your kids, not just do another STEM project in a box, which they're great, but not just do another craft in a box or like learn a new recipe or whatever. You get to do something and contribute back out into the world. And the big, again, if there are entrepreneur types listening to this, the big vision is, you know, it's a really unmanaged sort of $300 billion industry in the US where, again, think about this as an economy. It's crazy. $300 billion. $300 billion every year is given away in terms of time, talent, expertise by people who get, and again, air quotes, nothing in return. They get meaning. They get this knowledge. They're connected with something bigger than themselves, but it's not a well-managed interaction. I mean, there's all kinds of like incredibly developed donor grooming strategies that a lot of nonprofits have, but volunteers often just sort of fall under that bucket a little bit, or they get left by the wayside. Who's paying attention to and creating fantastic, beautiful, catalytic experiences for volunteers that ideally will then unlock much more, you know, inspiration and be a bridge to deeper involvement. So that's my vision. Work with the many, many, many would-be volunteers, especially families. It's really hard to get out of the house, as you and I know, with little kids. How can you activate families where they are at home while the baby naps and someone else has a snack and the, you know what I mean? How do you do that? I think this is a way. I hope it's a way. And that's our vision.
Love it. Well, I will sign up. Do I just go to altruist.com? I would love to do this with my kids.
Yes, altruist.com. Please sign up and you can get a subscription. You can do like send me a box every month, or you can get one box. There's a deep discount if you do three boxes or more, so you can get a little bundle. But I'm so proud of it. And I feel like I'm deeply in love again with the venture, kind of for the first time since Kiva. So it's my passion, and I'm really excited to share it with anybody out there who's listening. So thank you for checking it out.
Yeah. Well, we'll include links to all of that and everything that we discussed in the show notes. Thank you for the conversation. And more importantly, thank you for changing the world, not just through the organization, but by investing in your kids, by altruists and everything else that you're sending your hand to. You just make such an impact daily. And it's just been a joy to watch you from afar throughout your journey. And I'll continue to do so. So thanks again.
Thank you, Doug. It's such a pleasure to talk to you today. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, hey, leader, thank you so much for listening to my conversation with Jessica. I hope that you enjoyed it as much as I did. You can find ways to connect with her and links to everything that we discussed in the show notes at l3leadership.org/307. And as always, leader, I want to challenge you that if you want to 10x your growth this year, then you need to either launch or join an L3 Leadership Mastermind Group. Mastermind groups have been the greatest source of growth in my life over the last 5 years. And if you're unfamiliar with what they are, they're just simply groups of 6 to 12 leaders that meet together for at least 1 year on a consistent basis in order to help each other grow, go after their goals together, hold each other accountable, and to do life together. So if you're interested in learning more about masterminds, go to l3leadership.org/masterminds. And as always, leader, I like to end with a quote, and I'll quote Brian Houston, who said this recently. He said, "You learn more about people in the tough times than you ever will in the good times." Something to remember, leaders. Well, hey, I hope this episode encouraged you. Know that Laura and I love you. We believe in you. And leader, please keep leading. Don't quit. The world needs your leadership.